It's Thursday, May 10th, 2007, at the Michigan State University Libraries in East Lansing, Michigan. It's about 1:35 in the afternoon. Julio Cesar Guerrero, Diana Huiza Rivera, and Jose Cleofas Gonzalez. We're talking as part of an ongoing series of voices and experiences of Chicanos at Michigan State University and in the community. Well, welcome, Jose. And first of all, can you tell us your full name, where you live?
Jose Clovis Gonzalez. I live right now in Oregon, state of Oregon, city of Jervis.
Okay. You were a student at Michigan State University who was active, I believe, in Chicano student activities here. Can you tell us some information about you? First of all, your background, what city you came from in Michigan, and then like some of your experiences here at Michigan State.
Yes, I'd be more than happy to. I was born in Saginaw, Michigan, and I went to school at St. Joseph High. While I was going to school, we became very politicalized because most of the student body was Hispanics and Blacks, as there was a majority. We had 1% white population. But because we were minorities, majority of minorities, we became very politicalized about the war, about race, civil rights. So in a way, I was kind of really prepped to come to college.
Let me ask a question, specifically on that, on the particular issue of being politicized right. At that age and in their environment. Somehow we tend to associate race and class, mm-hmm. you know, together. But if we were to assume that the people of color in that high school were especially in the area of Saginaw, and I'm assuming, thinking back at that time, would it be safe to assume that most of the students' families were UAW auto workers?
Yes, they were. It was a factory town, actually. Uh-huh. My dad.
There were good times.
Yes,
around
good times.
That time, you know.
And bad times.
What years are we talking about here?
Well, roughly, talking about 69, 70.
So, Jose, if you were to tell me we were poor, we're, you know, marginated, oppressed, so then the work comes in, so we definitely had to react. But can I, what would be the class? Was it working class? Was it middle class? Your student generation, the community that you were politicized with, along with?
It was a working class.
Working class. Working they class. Had working class consciousness.
Yeah, like you mentioned before, it was a factory that employed my dad, you know, and again, he working full time, 40 hours a week, maybe 50 hours a week. But we had a large family, four sisters, five brothers. I was right in the middle. So it was still a struggle because trying to support the family and his wife, it was kind of tough at certain times, kind of tough. Until we, if we got young enough, but we could do odd jobs around the community, working in grocery stores and et cetera.
I'm curious as to how anybody at that age, which is a young age, you know, get politicized, especially, I mean, I know that Vietnam was all over the place. I mean, mm-hmm. It was in the living rooms, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was on the papers, it was in everybody's family.
Right, right.
But what do you think are the agents, per se, that got you or your community politicized to the degree of being vocal about it?
I think, like I said before, we were minorities. What was going on in the world then affected us, at least the way we looked at it. And we decided we should do something about it. And by doing something about it, we became more aware of what we should do, at least for my sake, you know. But I think it had to do, again, that we were minorities. And we since we were Blacks and Latinos, you know, we were young. We had to change the world. And we thought that we were responsible for it in actuality. And that's the way I think. And there were other factors too, you know, the teachers were very supportive. Half the teachers were Hispanic or minorities too, you know, Black. We have one white teachers and a couple of that, but mostly it was a Catholic school again.
At St. Joe's, they were
Catholics. Catholic nuns. They were nuns.
That's
also
correct. But they were Latinos, Latino teachers.
No. They were black teachers.
Oh, okay. But minority teachers. Yeah. Of course, I forget.
So then can we then say that state of mind is what led you to get into Michigan State and acquire higher education level of?
Yeah, that I stressed that I knew that I had deferred my education, and I had to educate the community. So the college opportunity arose where I grabbed it. I literally, when I turned 18, I just wanted to leave Saginaw because I knew I had to do something very important. I didn't want to get in that trap where I graduated, end up in a factory job, and that was the last day, especially what was going on at the time.
How did you decide to come here? Were you recruited, or how did you?
Yeah, there was a recruiter, Lita Trevino, and he did contact me. Well, I think at the time he was going to high schools, you know, and he knew about the St. Joe's, and he had a open day, I think, where he invited people, students, to attend MSU. And actually, there was also one in Notre Dame that was invited to too. And I went both of them. I went to Notre Dame, and I went to Michigan State. And then later on, I talked to him, and he was telling me about the financial aid that was available, which I thought, well, I couldn't afford it. I never would have afforded it, you know. But once he explained to me about the financial aid, I realized that I can do it. I can do it. And so I wasted no time. Although they never did send me a letter of acceptance. I just showed up one day in September, started school.
I want to go back, if I may, to something you said earlier of the mic. The reason you chose also to go to college was because of your your status with the draft. No, can you explain that?
Well, back then there was a draft lottery, but actually, to tell you the truth, I already senior in high school, the Army came and took me both practically, got all the boys out of school, and we went for a physical. And I started thinking, well, wait a minute, I haven't even graduated, and I'm doing this physical, you know? And I said, well, I think I know what might be going on. And then later on, they had the draft lottery, and my number was 5. That kind of motivated me too.
But so if you went to college, you would be, you wouldn't have to go to a, well, be drafted, right?
Well, as it is, my brother was in the Marines at the time. Mm-hmm. He served in the Marine Corps, and I felt that one brother is enough for this war. I mean, we did our part, and he did his part. Now, why do they want me for? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way I look at it. Mm-hmm. So that was also partial what motivated me. I had to do something in the community, and by being in the Army, I don't think I could have done anything. It's being a killing machine. So I didn't think that was my cup of tea.
As far as other Chicanos that came in with you, is your starting class was what, 1970? Or?
Yeah, the fall of 1970.
1970. Were there other Chicanos that were in the same situation that you know of, that you shared stories with?
There were other students in the same time, and we all had different styles and stories and everything like that.
But draft numbers, were they all in?
No. There were some that didn't even have to worry about the draft. They were here because they wanted to be here, unlike me, you know. So, no, there's every student I met, you know, they had their own stories, their own reasons why they were here. Okay. So there was never one central theme, you know.
What kind of environment did you find in campus coming out of Saginaw?
I found it a very strange environment. Again, we were living in a minority neighborhood. We had contact with a lot of Anglos, you know, but not as much as coming to school, and the majority of the population was all Anglo. So it was a kind of culture shock, you know, which I had to realize to get over it, because especially coming from a minority neighborhood. I mean, strictly minority, it was all black Hispanics. So again, I always wanted to state that it's just a culture shock. But I realized I had to get over it because, you know, it would interfere with what I wanted to do. And I did. But that was really what stood out to me.
You had a focus. You had a mission.
Yeah.
You had a reason to be here.
That's why.
Beyond educating yourself.
Sometimes I got discouraged, very discouraged, you know, but I didn't realize that I got to get over it. I got to do what I got to do.
What are some of the activities that you got involved to as part of getting over?
Well, a lot of things I started hanging around with some Hispanic students that I knew of, you know, and that seemed to help. started socializing with other people and students in my kind of area, you know. And I tried to concentrate in the studies too, you know, which I found really hard and difficult, you know. This was totally a different ballgame. So again, just being trying to be active, trying to be not being by myself, going out with students, fellow students, trying to get to know them, and they know me, you know. Socialization really helped a whole lot, really.
In terms of trying to find or build a community, identity is always an issue.
Right.
What was more or less the identity issues that you found at that time? And those now, you know, around, you know, past the 90s into this century, the Latino, Hispanic, whatever identity is a big issue, and it's very difficult to define. Back then, it was I think a narrower definition of who we were as a Latino as a community. Do you have any thoughts about that? Any memories to what was the identity that we that your community mostly focused on? What kind of identity they how did they identify themselves?
I think back then,
or was it not an issue? I don't know.
I personally, I don't think that was an issue, but no. But well, let me take that back. It's a Hispanic, okay, word to say.
Sure, it's your word.
The Hispanic community was still not totally aware where they stood. They weren't politicized. They were, again, maybe because they weren't educated, so they didn't really weren't involved in most of the stuff until they got personally involved. And I think that's part of my plan was to make sure that to make them understand they had a choice. They had a say in their lives, especially their daughters and sons. So I think that was a learning process for them too. We were all learning what we were, what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So there was, I traveled around, you know, those years, and I remember that when I was in Illinois, they said, well, you know, we are Chicanos from Illinois. You're not. You're from Texas.
Yeah.
Or you're Tejanos. Or you're
yeah. Exactly.
Or you're Californios. Or you're right. This or that. You know. There's always that little right. Bickering. You know.
Yeah.
Which is senseless, but it's part of our, you know, finding identity.
Right. Right.
And I'd imagine that in Michigan, mm-hmm. you know, we're from Saginaw. You're from Detroit. And we're from Lansing. You're from Crystal or Crystal City or whatever. You know, and that's part of the identity. I wonder if that was part of the things that you had to negotiate in building a community.
No, I think what really happened was that we had the common language, spoke Spanish. We all spoke Spanish. And that was a common bond between all of us, you know. Even though, like you mentioned, there were people who said, oh, I'm from Texas, you know, soy Tejano, you know. And you know, you can either ignore it or you can argue with it, but you accept it. You know, okay, so you're from Texas. I'm from Texas, so let's get it out. help-wise.
Right.
But I think the common bond, again, was the Spanish language. It kept us all one, so to speak, because we all spoke Spanish. Or some of us spoke more Spanish than the others.
Mm-hmm. How did you find each other on campus?
Well, there wasn't a guide, I tell you that. You just sort of socialized and talked to people, and automatically you would know someone that looked Hispanic, you know, you would approach them, or her, too, you know, and just introduce yourself as, you know, I'm Jose Gonzalez, I'm from Saginaw, and you're, that's usually what it was, socialization, you know.
Was there any particular place in campus or in East Lansing or in Lansing where you would congregate physically?
I can't say for most of the people, but for myself, there was one place, and it was called Quinto Sol. And that's where I realized that there was more political things going on there in the community, in the Lansing community. But as per se on the campus, there was nothing, except maybe Jose Trevino, you know. And later on, we had some financial advisor. Again, Jose Trevino was really with the magnet here. But as for our building, as for our center, nada.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about Quinto Sol?
You know, I've been thinking about that, and I want to say by accident, to tell you the truth, by accident. But once I did find out what they were doing, the word of mouth really was that there was these gentlemen. They were had a lawsuit against Michigan State, and they had decided to sue Michigan State. Mm-hmm. But in the process of suing Michigan State, they were being more active about building a radio station in the community. And slowly but surely, that got my attention. I started thinking that, you know, maybe they got something here going, and I want to be part of it. And sure enough, I did become part of Kingdom Sword.
What are some of the issues that, I think, traditionally, you know, in a campus-community relationship, you know, there are two worlds, you know, what goes on in campus and what goes on off campus, you know, outside of the community. And of course, that's characterized by the focus on issues that we may have in either of those two areas. The issues going on in campus that were of interest to you and your community, what would that be? Admissions, recruiting,
presentation? We had wanted to wheat Chicano studies. That was one of our issues that we brought up back then, that we didn't have anything that related to us or reflected us, you know, and that was one of the biggest issues we had on campus, Chicano studies. That was one of the major ones right there. And everything else that, again, came afterwards. But we really wanted Chicano studies. We wanted Chicano professors, you know, more of our race being part of that. And considering most of our migrant laborers before, and this was a land-grant college, we felt that it was owed us.
Any particular action that you remember might have been taken towards those particular issues?
Well, like I mentioned before, Gilbert Martinez, I remember him, he's the one that sued Michigan State because he felt that they owed us something for being migrant laborers at one time in our lives, and therefore by him suing us, they've got attention to everybody. Although we knew at the time that he didn't have a snowball's chance in hell, but just for him to do that made me aware that someone really knows what's going on and wants to do something about it. And although it was symbolic, you know, but it was something that we did something, we're trying to do something. And then, like I said, then when he started building that radio station, it also attracted me.
Communications is a big piece, as you mentioned, you know, the radio, the word of mouth. Mm-hmm. What other means that you recall you as member of that community?
Well, on campus, we started a student paper, Hispanic student paper, and on the community, we had the Quinto Sol paper. So through the paper, and then later on to the radio station, we started communicating with the people as to what issues we had, what problems we had, who to help who. But I remember that there was a student circulation newsletter, and then later on to Quinto Sol.
What was the name of the newsletter in campus?
You know, I failed to remember, but I remember printing it up and writing the article. The old-fashioned rolling thing, you know, and dropping it off practically every dorm that I could think of, you know, and just scattered all over campus. Later on, I managed to get the bulletin board on one of the cottages, and I talked to the RA about it, and he said, yeah, you can have it. So I used that bulletin board to put topics concerning Hispanics again, you know.
Do you remember the dorm?
I want to say, no, I don't. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But that was another means of communication on campus to let the students on campus know that who we were, what we were doing, and what we were trying to achieve.
Did you live in campus?
Oh, yeah. I lived in Hubbard Hall. It's one of the biggest buildings. I don't know if it still is.
Yeah. So in relation to Hubbard, was it like way across campus towards Lansing?
No, it was just the opposite. It was farther away from Lansing.
In terms of the dorm that you had access to that bulletin board.
It was, I believe it was a neighborhood, neighborhood dorm, you know. It's just that the RA there was more sympathetic to what I was trying to do and more willing to do it, you know. And I think it was just one semester, however, it was just about one semester, and so I think someone complained about it, you know. Or the other thing is that the black students said, hey, they got a board, we want a board. Then the Native Americans started doing the same thing, like, hey, they both got boards. And so rather than not to deal with that, they just canceled everything. So it wasn't a long time effort, but it was an experiment, you know. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what social activities did the Chicano students partake in, and were they on or off campus?
Most of them were off campus, you know. There were some students that had been there for some time, and they opened their doors to us, you know, and most of it was socialization, you know, thing. a coffee drinking, a party thing, a guitar playing, experimenting in music. You know, there were some artists in the group, you know, that wanted to try their style and compare it to Mexico, compare it to South America, you know, and even some Cubans, yeah. So mostly it was an educational process to get yourself familiar with not just yourself, not just Lansing, but worldwide activity that was going on. There was a lot of talk about the Third War, I mean Third World, you know, and so a lot of that activity was making you more aware that we're not alone. Mm-hmm. We're not alone. There's other people there, worse than we were, actually.
Yeah, in fact, the history of those years tells us that community and scholars were looking south as opposed to looking
north. That was very true. You know, we thought that by going south, we could have one of the best of the best, you know, pick their minds, so to speak, you know. And again, that was some of the thinking back then. It was, we took a look at the south, look at Mexico, look at Buenos Aires, you know, look at Chile, you know.
The I'm looking at what means you might have access to back then to reinforce, you know, your community activism. Because it's hard. I mean, when you find yourself, and in the Midwest, compared to, we were always comparing ourselves to the Southwest.
Yes, we were. You know?
And so we said in California, it's really where it's at. Texas, this is going on, and Colorado, things are happening. So we sort of felt like, you know, in many cases,
right.
If we were to compare ourselves, and so because of those reasons, you seek support. You know, way to reinforce, you know, your position. Anything that comes to mind, such as conferencias or national programs or you know, any other means that you might have access to?
Well, we weren't very organized back then. And we realized, like you mentioned before, we had a risk community. So by doing basic things for the community, we were trying to win their heart and mind, so to speak. Very basic, one program we managed to get fun, I mean barely managed to get fun, was the drug and alcohol program. Even back then, we realized there was a bad problem in the Hispanic community. And so we decided to get funding for that. But most of it was staffed by volunteers like myself. I would take time out of school, and mostly on the weekends, and like a 4-hour shift there, you know. And since we all spoke Spanish, we were aimed at to help the community with the drug and alcohol problems. And what little budget we had, we did have the house that we tried to operate out of. And then we naturally started communicating, word of mouth, newspaper, letting the community know that we're here to try to help in any way possible. That was one possibility right there. That's what one of the programs stands out to me.
So someone wrote a grant then for this program?
Mario Souza, I believe he was the one that wrote a grant to the city of Lansing. But again, he could only get fund for the building. The staffing was all volunteers, and I was one of the volunteers.
Okay, so Mario Souza wrote a grant to the
city of Lansing.
To the city of Lansing. Okay, thank you.
You talked about newspapers.
Yes,
on campus and off campus as well.
Right.
But you also mentioned other means of communications before, such as a theater group.
Teatro Campesino. We used to have this Teatro Campesino, we called it, and it was for to community awareness about some issues that affect us all, you know, war, race, communication, self-identity, who we were, to be proud of ourselves. And we tried to encompass that in the plays, certain plays that we tried to do. And we tried, again, we had some artists that were talented guitarists. We had some artists that were talented writing skills, you know, playwrights, you know, and most of it though was done around, like, sitting around the table drinking coffee and trying to see, well, how would we do a play about the war in Vietnam? And how would we do a play about the plight of the migrant? And how would we do a play about education? You know, and how would we do a play about drug and alcohol? But we knew we had to do it, not a long play, but just enough to get the attention of the individual, which I think sometimes lasts like 10 minutes,
right.
If you're lucky, maybe 15
right.
minutes.
Yeah.
So we concentrated on making it quick, direct, and that way fast, so that way they would realize and not be sitting bored, you know. And also we tried to make it more active, that way they would kind of be aware of what's going on. But the message was, again, yeah, that we were trying to send the message. This is being done. We should be doing something about it. And by these plays, we're trying to educate. Most of the plays we did were for high school students because we knew they were the young. They were still our chance to catch them before they did something else. And also make them aware that the drug alcohol problem and the racists in the army recruiting the minorities, the high percentage of the minorities were recruited. So we tried to send that message, you know, hey, is there something wrong here? Let's do something about it. But again, the time spans, the attention span, we knew it had to be 10 minutes, maybe 50 minutes of the case.
Did you ever work in the field, so?
Yeah. The summer jobs, like I said before, I come from a large family. Every summer we had, I don't know if you know, in Michigan there had a large potato population, potato farm, you know, cherries up north. Summertime was one of the times that all of us went up north for the cherries, you know. Or in the summer in the local valley areas, but I think it was potatoes most of the people. Yeah, a sack of potatoes, and, you know, that kind of work. Then I remember also the cucumbers.
Yeah.
And then the weeding, naturally the weed, you had to weed the rows of for the weeds, yeah. So some of that we did.
What was it, like beets and beans?
Beets and beans, there you go.
Yeah, that's what we did, beets and beans.
Yeah, so
I wanted to, I'm sorry, just jump back a bit to the teatro, because I read just here and there on in Quintos or in the Sol de Aslan about the student group taking plays like to Flint and to Saginaw and here in Lansing. And I thought the name I saw was Teatro Estudiantil de Michigan State. Is that different than the teatro that you
were? I think it involved, you know, like I said, we were still in the learning process, you know, and we were trying to just get the attention of the community, you know, and we tried different names, you know. I believe it might have started that way.
Okay.
But then we realized, you know, we should change the name again to the Teatro Campesino, which is more, I thought it was more attractive.
Okay. And do you recall the cast, or what do you call them, cast members, or...
Cast members.
The cast members for that teatro. Who
just
was
members of the group.
Members of your group.
Mike was one.
Yeah, Mike Reyes.
Mario was in it, too.
Yeah,
Mario Sosa.
Yeah. Mario Sosa. Hinata was our guitarist, but I don't remember his last name. Barajas, I want to say Barajas, but I'm not too sure. Then there was myself, and then there was my wife, Diana.
Was she the only female?
No, there were other females, but again, I have no problem remembering that far back. No, there were other females. There was an equal male and female ratio.
In any of your teatro productions, was anything focused on the woman?
I'm sorry, I no, there was other concerns at the time, the race wars and the war of Vietnam. And the self-acknowledgement of who we were and what we were.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was a given time we would have concentrated, you know, but now during the time it was what we thought was important.
Mm-hmm.
I remember somehow an association between teatro activism and the Brown Beret organization. Was there any relations that you can remember between?
There was no really connection between the students and the Brown Berets. The Brown Berets was an organization created in Saginaw, Michigan, and they really didn't have anything to do with the student organization. I was a member of the Brown Berets, but it wasn't because I was a student. It was more that, again, you wanted to see who was doing something for the community, and they seemed to be doing something for the community. But the connection between the students and the Brown Berets, there was none. As if you wanted to consider me, I was a student at the time.
What is your characterization of the Brown Berets?
They wanted to be a military organization similar to the Black Panthers. That's what they wanted to be. But they never did quite reach that point, you know, because there was always political infighting in the Brown Berets. One faction wanted to go bomb, et cetera, et cetera. The other one was education. Let's go to the community to pass out pamphlets, leaflets, and let them know who we are and what we are. But again, we want to be similar to the Black Panthers.
La Raza Unida also was kind of cropping up around that time.
It was
in Michigan, is that correct?
Yes, there was. In fact, there was a, I don't want to say confrontation, but there was the conference that they were having, and we sort of crashed.
Kurt Lansing?
I was there. Were you there?
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of crashed that place. No,
who crashed it?
Brown Berets.
Brown Berets.
Brown Berets.
See, what happened is that La Raza Unida was an organization of, it's a loose organization of individuals and community-based organizations. And it was led by Ruben Alfaro.
Ruben Alfaro.
Donatín's dad. And so it was coordinated in Lansing. I don't know where in Lansing. Was it like a community college? Was it a community college?
It's like an auditorium conference.
It was an auditorium. Yeah. And so it was like a big assembly, you know. Right. We spent the whole day or weekend.
Radford High School. It might have been.
Is that right?
According to the booklet.
Well, so that's where it is. So I remember somebody had a picture of Che Guevara on the stage, on the podium, and there was a Cuban guy in the audience that says, "I refuse to be part of an organization that uses Che Guevara, international terrorist and assassin, blah, blah, blah." And then all of a sudden you see this Brown Berets marching instead of the podium, "Viva Che! Viva Che! Viva Che!" And it really got loud, man. I mean, not violent, but, you know.
We took over the story.
It took over the damn conference, you know.
We did.
Did you know that there was going to be some taking over of the podium or the
I want to say that we weren't invited.
Okay.
The Las Vegas was more conservative part of the Hispanic community. And they didn't really address the problems that we saw that were important. But again, they were very conservative, non-political, which we felt that we should be more politicized. And it actually was that, again, we weren't invited. So we kind of crashed the party.
Can you give maybe just a short list or an idea of what La Raza Unida, what their, not goals, but what they were concerned with and what Brown Berets were concerned with,
Well, to sum it up briefly, the La Raza Unida were a very conservative organization that had, I believe at the time, they wanted patience. They wanted a slow change. They said nothing happens overnight. Again, that was the main difference between us and them, is that they wanted the time to pass. They wanted, and we're talking about years, we're not talking about months, you know. As opposed to us, we were very active. Now's the time to grab the moment, so to speak, you know. We have to do something now. We can't wait another 10 years. It was a loss of time. And that's really what the basic difference was.
And also, yeah, it was more on mediation, negotiation, assimilation mode.
And then a lot of people of La Raza Unida were older people, you know.
Okay.
And as opposed to the Brown Berets, were all young.
And worked for the system as well.
Yeah, they worked that's right. They did work for the system. The way we looked at it, they worked for the system. So I don't want to say sellouts, but, you know, at the time,
But that was their mode of operation.
Yes, that was simply what the mode of operation, I suppose, the Brown Berets. Again, we felt that had to be done sooner than later.
Right.
Now, preferably.
Okay. The Catholic Church, what role did it play in Chicano activism at that point in time?
I think they also were aware of what was going on, and since the majority of Latinos were Catholics, they realized that they had to do something to get involved, because simply most of the majority of them were Catholics. And we did turn to the Catholic Church for help, made them aware, and they luckily some of them did help us, and some of them didn't. Again, it's just one of those things that some were more sympathetic than others. But the Catholic Church per se, officially, didn't really want to get involved at all. It was just the local community churches in the Chicano bodies, you know, that were more active than any ones.
We're talking Saginaw, Lansing.
Yeah, we're talking Lansing. Saginaw.
Well, statewide, because the diocese funded Ruben's position.
Yeah, that's right.
Who was the main organizer for not Michigan alone, but the entire Midwest. And he was a very key player in the development of the Chicano community and throughout the region. They also gave a grant to Quinto Sol.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which it was supposed to be a loan, but Quinto Sol never paid it back. so it was, that was the end of that. But they did, just like in those two cases, I'm sure they funded other projects as well. You know, they like you said, I think they never took an official position on anything.
Exactly.
But they were working with the community.
Yeah, quietly behind the scenes sort of thing. You know.
So you have La Raza Unida, not La Raza Unida Party, but La Raza Unida, the Michigan.
Incorporated.
And then Brown Berets, and the church is kind of help, not condoning, but helping, aiding in some way or another. Did they lean more towards La Raza Unida or Brown Beret because of age? Or for any reason that the church leaned more towards one group than the other when it's
supporting? Yeah, the Catholic Church, like the La Raza Unida, were very conservative, as opposed to we were more, like, as an interpreter.
Volatile.
Yeah, okay, I didn't want to use that word, but...
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you're right, it was volatile. And also, some of us were believed in the communist system, which, well, he revolutionized, well, it was Castro, took over Cuba, you know. So a lot of our thinking was, again, if you're a communist, you don't believe in God. And so that's why the Catholic really didn't really like us.
But at the same time, you have to remember that a lot of the priests and nuns were involved in the Cesar Chavez campesino movement.
Well, yeah, I remember one particular priest, he said the real teaching of Christ is to help your fellow man. And he started realizing that by helping fellow man was to overthrow the government of some of those South American cities. And he became a guerrilla, actually, because it was the teachings of Christ, mm-hmm. the way they interpreted, you know. Again, the main concept was to help your fellow man. And if the system was oppressing you, you had to fight the system.
Mm-hmm. Was he a Lansing priest?
Or? I like to say so, but no, he wasn't.
No?
No.
Oh, yeah. Where was he from?
I believe he was in... from South America.
Oh, South America. Okay, all right.
As a segue into the farm workers movement, you were involved in local boycott.
Yes, the grapes.
What are some of the things that you did? Recollection of those years.
Okay, well, mostly as Brown Berets, we organized the group and we organized signs, and we still have some of the stores that were selling grapes. But to be fair, there were some stores that we talked to them first and told them this is oppressing the market labor, and then we want to know if you will support us, but not buying these particular grapes. They were from California. The grapes from South America, that's fine with us, but mainly it was the grapes from California that we wanted to make people aware that, again, they were being oppressed. And trying to link in with Cesar Chavez. So most of the things we did, we organized ourselves, and we got signs up, and then we would march around the storefront. We were very careful not to block the store's entrance because the police and the FBI were keeping close eye on us. So what? By not violating their privacy or violating the entrance, we knew that they could see, but they really couldn't really approach us because we weren't doing nothing illegally.
Which stores were they seeing?
AP, I want to say AP at the time. AP was one of the biggest ones that had the California grapes.
Frandor? At the Frandor Plaza, over here by Sears.
The only one that comes to mind was the one in Saginaw, AP in Saginaw.
Mm, okay.
But that was one of the things we did, was to get signs and, you know, and sing songs and march.
Saginaw City or Saginaw Avenue?
Saginaw City.
Okay.
The one
I'm... But you also participate in some UFW activities here in Lansing.
Yeah. We try to, as much as possible, be active, try to be, spread the community word about what we... should be doing. So yeah, we were very active.
Well, see, that was my reference to your background as a farm worker.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose we can say that well, see, Michigan at that time, around the decade anyway, had the second largest demand in the whole country of my farm labor.
Right.
It was California, Michigan, and Texas. Or Florida, you know, one of those four. But Michigan was at the very top, one of the very top states. And so, hence the concentration of campesinos in Michigan. And I think that homogenous, you know, background of the Latino community led to the state of activism and politicization that you referred to,
right,
you know, and the working class consciousness, you know, background. There's no denial. I mean, you know, that as to who we were as Mexicanos, you know, mm-hmm. associated with the farm workers issues and all of that. And so when Cesar Chavez comes sends the news that the farm workers are organizing in California and this is calling for this national movement. Then it was natural only, you know, to be part of the movimiento. Had we been, you know, intellectuals or auto workers or bricklayers or service, I don't think the identification would have been as significant, brother.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
Do you find any parallel between what was going on back then and what's going on right now as far as your understanding of the community?
I think back then we were more active, but maybe it was because we had to be more active. I think now there are changes going on, positive changes, and maybe sometimes working within the system does help, you know. But as to similarities, the only one I can refer to is the war in Iraq right now. That was a common theme that the concept was in our background, that the Vietnam War was killing us, literally killing us. And it, by lasting so long, it did kill a lot of our brothers and sisters, you know. But that's the only similarity I want to say, you know.
People would argue that, you know, we don't, quote unquote, protest anymore. We're not as active anymore because we've made some gains. What would be your characterization of that?
I think, like I said before, that we're in the system now. Some of us are in the systems, and we're realizing now that politically we can do more changes than we ever have done. Some of us might be wearing a tie and a shirt, but deep down inside we know that we are changing things. We are slowly changing things, yeah. And we're starting to get into positions of authority and power, and with the idea that now I'm in charge and there will be some changes. I think that is slowly what happened. And I think that, you know, you have to change, adapt. The old ways, the world goes, the marches, it was probably at that time. But now, since some of us are in positions of authority, we realize now that if you work within the system and do things that you know you have more power in, things are changing.
I have to ask you this question.
Just go ahead.
Playing the devil's advocate, don't you think that what you're saying now is what the rest of the members of La Raza Unida organization were thinking or saying back then in the 60s and 70s? And you were screaming at them as a young brown beret?
Again, like I said, the idea back then was that we were very young. We wanted to set the world on fire. By being very young, we weren't experienced enough to realize some of the things that do work. Diplomacy does work. You don't have to come up with a big hammer all the time. If you carry a hammer all the time, if that's the only tool you got, everything's going to look like nails. So again, you know, the diplomacy works. It does work. You should have all kinds of tools in your shed, you know, for every appropriate action. I think at that time it was necessary to be active. It was necessary to get the potential of the people. It was necessary to get control of our elders, to make them realize, you know, something had to be done. But again, it was only one tool. There was a lot of tools you use. And yet, as you get older, you start to realize, yeah, I don't need a hammer all the time. You know, maybe a piece of paper sometimes.
You were directly involved in many of the activities, you know, that are part of history now. What would be your analysis of the changes that were brought about because of those type of activities that you and other, you know, of your counterparts, you know, took part of?
Well, like you mentioned before, there were others besides myself, and I just want to say that I wanted to do what I could do as part of the whole, you know. I never considered myself as really the key element. Again, there's like a puzzle, the pieces come together. And I think later, earlier, I think I told you that by words of communication, by doing certain things and working within the family and community, it starts to internet. The word starts to spread. And because the word, you know, is being mentioned by mouth, and it spreads faster and faster. But I don't want to take any credit for starting this and starting that. At the time, I didn't even realize what sometimes I was doing. You had your experiment, a lot of stuff worked.
Because in many of our views, whether you like it or not, you're part of history, you know, as an individual or as a member of a particular time. But the question is, out of that time and where you're at now, you know, looking back, if you will, what changes do you think that you know, came about from those years, or to what extent were we effective?
Well, what I have to say is that I think we did manage to get the attention of the university, and we did get attention of the Chicano studies that are being done right now. We actually relocated more minority students, not just Hispanics, you know. I think those are some of the major changes that happened that were positive for the community and for the college itself. Chicano studies now, I understand, exists.
That's great.
Back then, it was just a dream.
I want to hear a personal story about you going out into the community to recruit students as a volunteer.
Again, I try to concentrate it on family and friends mostly, because these are the people that you know, people that will listen to you, rather than someone off the street trying to talk to your sister or your brother about things that, you know, maybe they don't care about. So mostly it was one of the things about the organization, we realized that you start out small. You start out with the small stuff first, and then eventually it starts to grow and grow, if you're doing it right. Now, if you're not doing it right, it won't grow at all. So you have to stick with the basics first, simply the basics.
Would you go during the summer or during the semester? Or
it was a 24-hour job.
24-hour job, not all year round, though. Was it all year round?
Oh, it was year round.
Is that right, really?
At least the way I did. It was any given opportunity I had to talk, I did talk. And I didn't see any time frame.
You were a fanatic, was it?
Yeah. I don't think so.
Was there a structure that you guys started with? Or how did you decide, you know what, today I'm going to go recruit a little Chicano or a little Chicanita to MSU? How did it come about?
Some of them were more active than others, I'll tell you the truth, you know. Some of them considered it like a job, they only did it certain times. I myself considered it like a mission, you know. And I was always doing it, regardless of what time of the day it was, where I was at. If you paid attention to me, then I know that you were interested. If you ignored me, then I just walked away. It was like, but again, there was no structure time. And by experiment, actually, because like I said before, there's some people who will listen to you, some people that won't listen to you. And through experience, you realize, well, I you don't want to listen to what I say, but you do. So I'll let me take some time to talk to you about this, you know. And by nature, I guess, my nature is to be able to speak to people, talk to people. But also to recognize, you know, when you're wanted and when you're not wanted. And that's very important.
Especially when la familia mexicana.
Oh, yes, definitely. La familia mexicana. You got to make sure that you didn't offend them in any way possible. So you try to talk to the father usually first, and then with his permission, then you would talk to the family. But without his permission, it's about it, though. Mm-hmm.
I had a question, but the family issue came up and that I got distracted.
I do have one that I just want to kind of slip in there. So you were doing this pretty much the way I understand other Chicano students were. Hey, you know, we got here, we got to recruit, but you weren't necessarily a group like Mayo or Mecha. What student organizations were here when you were here?
None. Okay.
And did you see any evolving while you were here?
Yes. Finally, we did organize. We got together, and that's where Mecha came about. You know, but when I first came out, it was nothing.
Did you participate in any conference outside of Lansing? A national conference? There were many, several.
Yeah, we went to the national conference in Denver, Colorado.
The youth conference.
The youth conference, yeah. Corey Gonzalez at the time has been active in the community.
The Crusade for Justice.
Yeah, there you go. And the interesting part about it is that we found out that he brought this building without government funds, without any kind of funds at all. And he convinced us that we could do it. We don't need the government telling us what to do or giving us money to do it. We can do it ourselves. And by showing us his business, showing us what he had done before, we were very impressed. That's one that stands out mostly.
There's a fundamental issue of ideology, you know, in that message, in that story alone, you know, that La Raza Unida didn't have it right if they wanted to mediate and had to negotiate a compromise,
right,
you know, in order to get something out of society where this other perspective is, we can do it on our own. We don't have to wait 5 years till the legislature passes it. a bale or saw, right? So
right, we can start. Exactly right, exactly right.
Yeah. Well, what I find peculiar, Jose, is that you know, you put so much time into bringing students into campus. You came into campus with a specific purpose and focus of you know, spreading your education, which you did in many cases. But in the end, you didn't graduate.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. What's that about?
Well, I think what was that about, you get it to a certain time in your life that you realize maybe it's time for me to go on. Maybe it's time for me to do something different. I've been a student for, 3 years? Did I really achieve anything? So I questioned myself a lot, you know. And then the Vietnam War winding down. And again, like I said, you question yourself, maybe it's time for me to do something else, something different, or just start my life again, you know. I got involved with this woman that turned later on to be my wife. I started getting family responsibilities. Those are something that happens, you know. You don't plan on it, but it does.
No, I don't hold that against it, that you didn't graduate. I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
I do.
In many cases, it's a good thing, you know.
Yes.
But you know, you look at the just juxtaposition of issues. I mean, here you are aggressively recruiting somebody like Deanna here, you know, and
right.
other people,
right.
24 hours a day, 24/7, right. as we say, and then you say, I don't need education myself, you know. There are better things for me to do. I think that's peculiar.
For us, it was, I mean, I think that when you look at, like, maybe even who was doing recruiting initially was Mr. Treviño, Jose
right.
Treviño,
yes.
that and you mentioned that you got here and there was no aid package.
Right.
And I've talked to many students who were recruited by Treviño, you know, right out of the fields. Hey, do you want to go to MSU? Or show up here at this date?
Exactly.
I mean, and he never really was a admissions officer or recruiter for longer than one season because of how he was getting us in.
Right.
And yet he worked and worked on his, I think he was on his PhD here towards the end before he passed on. He never got it, but God,
no,
did he get
did.
A lot of us in?
Yeah, he did.
You know, so
yes,
he did. It was funny.
Well, we've done 50 minutes. So any reflection?
I still have a couple of questions, if I may. I
know, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm just you know, bringing up the
Diana Villastrigo became
yes.
your wife.
Yes, she did.
There were several other women that were here as students.
Yes, they were.
What role did they play in student activism?
They had a major part of the student activism. They, like we were, the males, they were our counterpart partners, you know. They were very dependent to be notified and communicate with other students. They did whatever they could do to try to help us any way possible. Yeah, they were very active.
Yeah. Right around that time, Women's Lib was coming up and about.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the mainstream females talking about women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And from your perspective, because of course you can't necessarily interpret what somebody else's experiences are, but looking back now, 35 years, maybe 40, looking back at the Chicanas that were involved, what's your perspective of their role? Like, did they just kind of say female?
Did they burn the bra?
Gender, yeah, that or gender issues aren't important? Or what was your perspective of the women's role?
Well, like you said, I'm not a woman, so I really can't say much about it, but I can just tell you that the Chicanas here were, at the time, was just like you mentioned, it was just coming out, you know. But all I can say is that the way they were grown, the way they grew up, respect for the male figure, still played a major part of it. Even though politically they were starting to become more aware that they had strength in numbers and there were other issues, the women issues, that they needed addressed too. So I think at that time they were still realizing that they also had some issues that had to be addressed. But unfortunately, at the time, they were drowned out by the major issues, the war in Vietnam, Chicano studies. But it was eventually put on the agenda, finally, towards the end, you know. But again, like I said, most of the Chicanos that were here, they, again, supported the male figure, mostly. Even though they were very strong individuals on their own, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. Okay. That was my question. I wanted to make sure that I got
in there. Sure. Any recollection of the political sense of La Raza Unida Party out of Texas? Were you informed in contact with them?
No, I wasn't. I was never.
But you were aware, though.
I was aware, but like I mentioned before, I was never invited, or was a member of.
The political party out of Texas, though.
I had no idea.
Okay. Any reflection as to based on what you know now of the present situation and the past experiences, where are Latinos heading in this century that we're in now, considering all the factors that we have on the table?
Well, like I mentioned before, I think now that there's a lot of us in position of authority, power, you know. And I think we are making some changes, you know, even though some people don't see the changes, but they are being made. There are graduating things that are going on right now. We might not be that vocal anymore, but as I mentioned before, there's different tools for different situations, and people have to realize that. Back then, you had to be vocal, you had to be noisy, and blah, blah, blah. Today, now, it's just more important that you hire the Hispanic female or Hispanic male and put him in the position or her in authority. But I think it's still going on, but it's going maybe more quieter than it did, which was more necessary in the 70s. I think that's what it is.
As a Chicano alumni of Michigan State University, what words would you share with future Chicano students that will be coming in about?
I think he'd be a good speaker to the Chicano Studies program now. Planted the seed. But go ahead, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So you were one of the first Chicanos here on campus.
Mm-hmm.
What words of wisdom would you have for students today, given the issues that they're still facing? And it's a broad spectrum of everything from international with the undocumented worker and the Minutemen Project to getting decent financial aid, to now the ban of affirmative action at MSU or in Michigan.
All I can say is it's going to be the best of times and it'll be the worst of times. That's all I can say.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure, anytime.